Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Today's guest, Tom Perez, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, who today becomes the first person I brought to you twice. The first time was almost exactly a year ago. We were in a bar in St. Louis, and he was in the final week of his campaign to be elected chair. It's a pretty unexciting job and usually not a prominent one, but the race had gotten intense and tribal, and Bernie Sanders was backing Keith Ellison, and Obama had recruited Perez into the race. Go back and listen to that episode if you want, but you can hear that Perez had lost his voice, and I can tell you, from looking across the table at him that night, he was on the verge of collapse. But he won, and the prize was getting to run an institution that itself was on the verge of collapse. I spent a lot of time covering the DNC, and I can tell you that though a lot of people out there got consumed by the allegations of rigging and other machinations, what was going on in that building for the last few years didn't resemble so much a meeting of the Illuminati as a meeting of the Muppets. Then there was the Russian hacking. Then there was a year of finances being drained and people quitting. Perez told me in another conversation we had just before Christmas that I knew it was a turnaround job when I ran, but I undeniably underestimated the depth of the turnaround job. There's a story I wrote up on our website right now about how everything at the DNC is coming together, or isn't, and I'd encourage you to read that. But there's also the story of Perez, who is a guy I've known since he was labor secretary, and can be a wonky guy who gets caught up in awkward lines that he thinks come off a lot smoother than they do. You'll hear some of that in the podcast. But can get intense behind the podium, like he did in a speech I heard him give at Al Sharpton's National Action Network breakfast here in D.C. for Martin Luther King Day, railing against what he calls the appalling silence of the Republican Party. So, easy task for Perez. He's got to bring the DNC back from near death, oversee efforts for the midterms for a party that's feeling good about pickups, though a lot of that is because they've lost so much there's nowhere left to go but up. He's got to convince voters who've written off the Democratic Party that there's some reason to come back, hold together the internal divisions that a lot of Sanders supporters still feel and keep pushing on, and along the way assert himself as a leader of the Democratic Party, even though the only campaign he ever won was for county council in Montgomery, Maryland. You'll hear a little from him also about what motivates him, a mix of his personal story and, of course, Hamilton lyrics. You'll hear a lot more conversations like these in the year ahead as we drill down on the midterms, how they're taking shape, and what's driving them. Next up, Steve Stivers, the Ohio congressman and chair of the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, which is in charge of overseeing House races for the GOP. He's got a big task ahead of him, too. So make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts or however you're listening, and you've told a friend or a coworker to subscribe, too. I'm telling you, when Zach and I have been sitting going over the schedule for now, just going into the spring, it's some really exciting stuff, people I can't wait to talk to and can't wait to bring to you. Remember to follow me on Twitter and like me on Facebook at Isaac Dover, and keep sending those emails to isaac@politico.com. It really helps to know what you're thinking and whom you'd like to hear more of. And now, my conversation with Tom Perez, sitting in his office at the DNC headquarters. You are a civil rights lawyer. You're someone who has spent a lot of time on these issues. How does it make you feel when you think about the bust of Martin Luther King in the Oval Office still?
Well, I think about that in the context of not simply his remarks today, but his actions. And I think about my own family, quite frankly. My family came from the Dominican Republic. We proudly share an island with the remarkable people of Haiti, who just marked the 8th anniversary of a horrific earthquake. My family, and frankly, my faith, teach me that you help your neighbor. When they are down and out, you make sure you lift them up. And as we celebrate the anniversary of Martin Luther King, on a basic level, this president is the antithesis of Martin Luther King. And not just that, I think what's more important is, Dr. King once said that to ignore evil is to become an accomplice to it. And the most recent remarks of the president should come as a surprise to no one, because they're along a lengthy line.
Is it just the word? Is it just, okay, it's shithole, like, and people get... Some of it to me seems like, I wonder what the response would have been if he had called them garbage dump countries. And that some of it is like a reaction to just the word, oh, the president curses. But it's
well,
deeper,
me,
right?
Well, actually, I mean, you refer to the S-holes of Haiti and Africa, and then you contrast it with Norway.
Right.
That when you are referring to people by their race. That is the definition of racism. But to
he's a racist
what
to you?
Is well, to me, I think the issue, I would add misogynist to it, but in light of the most recent allegations that we see coming out from the Wall Street Journal. But to me, I want to get back to the equally important point, because Donald Trump saying and doing things that divide America has regrettably and unconscionably become a dog bites man story. What to me is striking is the appalling silence of Republicans. It is clear to me that the party of Lincoln is officially dead. It has become the party of Trump, Moore, Arpaio, Ryan, McConnell. Paul Ryan said in response to his comment on Haiti, that was unfortunate. You know, it's unfortunate when it rains before a Nats game. It's unconscionable when somebody does something like that.
And it was a real contrast to what he said during the campaign when Trump in the summer of 16 made the comments about Judge Curiel not being able to be an impartial judge. And Ryan then described it as textbook racism. And well, this was just, it's an unfortunate and unhelpful comment.
Well,
right?
I think you're strengthening my point, which is that now that we're in governance, Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and the other Republicans in the House and the Senate, they see Donald Trump as their vehicle. This is a time around the MLK holiday for moral leadership. And we have seen the abject abdication of moral leadership by the Republican Party. And that's why I'm so proud to be a Democrat, to fight for opportunity for everyone.
You told me a couple of weeks ago you felt like the Republican Party has lost its soul.
The Republican Party is dead. The party of Lincoln is dead. The party of Trump is the party of Ryan, is the party of McConnell, is the party that supported Roy Moore. The RNC was giving money to Roy Moore's campaign. Joe Arpaio, a convicted felon who got pardoned by Donald Trump, is running proudly for the U.S. Senate in Arizona. That's today's Republican Party.
Except that the Republican Party is in the majority and in the House and the Senate and most of the governors around the country and is the White House. It's not dead.
Well,
in pretty
we will
good shape.
See. And you know what? We looked at 2017, and the American people have now looked at the party of Trump. You are correct that after the 2016 election, we had that alignment. But when you look at 2017 and what happened the last time Democrats won both gubernatorial races in New Jersey and in Virginia.
Yeah, no, but
was
isn't 20, that like
2005.
People go with statistics about this stuff? And when's the last time that a Democrat won a Senate race in Alabama? You wouldn't.
Well, it was 25 years
right.
ago. Actually,
right.
I happen to
but
know
you wouldn't
the answer
base
to that question.
That and the predictions of what would happen if you were if you were predicting. Based on what happened the last couple of Senate races in Alabama, then you would have said that the Republican, in this case Roy Moore, would have won in Alabama. But you, my point is, like, there's something really tricky going on with politics, and it seems like saying, okay, well, just because in 05, you're right, Democrats won in Virginia and in New Jersey, then that means, and 06 ended up being a good year for Democrats. That
well, past, I mean, well, here, let me say this. What you just said is accurate, but also I totally recognize that past is not necessarily prologue. That's why we've invested so much money in the Democratic Party in organizing early, organizing everywhere, and making sure that we are playing everywhere, that we are competing everywhere. Our motto is every zip code counts. That's why I was proud to invest early in Doug Jones's campaign. We were proud to invest in races in Oklahoma this past summer, special elections in beat red Trump country where state legislative candidates from the Democratic side were able to pull off upset victories because they were speaking to the values of Oklahomans. And so we can do this. I think we've demonstrated our model of success, and now we have to scale it in 2018.
You didn't answer the first question that I asked you, though, and I want to bring it back to it. Martin Luther King's bust is in the Oval Office. He looks at President Trump figuratively every day. It was a big deal that people were wondering. Obama was the one who brought that bust in, and Trump kept it there, and it was this whole controversy on the first day whether it was there. It's there. I mean, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's rank hypocrisy. I mean, Martin Luther King embodied moral leadership. Donald Trump embodies the antithesis of moral leadership. Martin Luther King 50 years ago was heading down to Memphis, Tennessee, because there was a sanitation workers' strike. I am a man is what they were fighting for. And they were fighting for dignity. They were fighting for the right to organize. 50 years later, Donald Trump is trying to eviscerate the right to organize. And later this year, unfortunately, I predict that the Supreme Court is going to make it harder for public sector unions to organize workers. And so
probably with a vote from Neil Gorsuch.
With the swing vote coming from Justice Neil Gorsuch, a seat that was stolen by the Republican Party. Absolutely. And so the rank hypocrisy of putting Martin Luther King in your office when you are the antithesis of that moral leadership. Martin Luther King was bringing people together, working in coalition, and Donald Trump is all about driving people apart, dividing America.
You wouldn't say the word shithole earlier, but I was thinking in the last couple of days about there was a rash of Democrats cursing in the spring of last year, and you were one of them, right? You said at a rally outside the White House, some Republicans don't give a shit about people, right? You said that in front of the White House.
Did I say that?
like I said, it's a podcast. Go ahead and curse. And the response to that was from some people, like, I can't believe Democrats are getting so coarse and vulgar.
Well, I would also note the irony that in the aftermath of that, if you look at the Republican National Committee, they feigned just horror that a leader of a party would utter such a statement. And once again, in the aftermath of what Donald Trump has said about Haiti and other countries in Africa, silence from the RNC. When Roy Moore was getting ready for that final election, what did the RNC do? They went back in, all in.
As soon as the president decided that he wanted to support.
Absolutely. And, you know, there were people.
And I heard from people who were engaged with what was going on, feeling outside the White House, but among Republicans, of sort of disbelief that that was happening.
Well, again, the party of Lincoln is dead. This is now the party of Trump. And the reason why Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and other Republicans have a sock in their mouth is because the leader, in fact, of the Republican Party and the Republican movement is Donald Trump. And they are perfectly content putting up with someone who says a few things that might give them a little bit of heartburn, but that heartburn pales in comparison to their desire to help their wealthy donors. I thought Chris Collins, the congressman from upstate New York, put it best when he says about the tax bill, you know, my donors are telling me, get it done or don't call me again. I mean, Lindsey Graham, who's periodically criticized the president, said, you know, if we don't pass that, our contributions will stop. This
and
is
Lindsey
what
Graham, who was one of the people who was in the Oval Office, apparently, for that remark from the president, who put out a statement on Friday, finally saying that he disagreed with what was said, but he wouldn't confirm what was said, which is like this weird road.
I mean, you know, the Washington Post has documented, I think, 2,000 false statements,
yeah,
provably false statements from this president. There's no
but
one in America
is like,
who doubts.
But
and even
but
Lindsey
Graham
is,
when you it's this weird thing where you have a Republican senator saying about the president, I disagree with what the president said. I'm
if
not
he
gonna,
said it.
Right.
I mean, that is laughable, which is why I am laughing at the moment, Isaac. I mean, I think what's sad about this is it prevents us from tackling the business at hand. I am singularly focused at the DNC on fighting for the issues that people care most about.
Do you think that we pay too much attention to this when you know, chip renewal is out there and is not moving, when you know, we don't yet have any sense of whether there will be a DACA deal or what it would be if it actually
goes
through?
This is another example of distracting Donald. I mean, he comes in, he says something.
But you think
that's
deliberate?
Well,
you think
you,
that he
I mean,
said what he like this? This is part of his game.
Well, the convert. I mean, there are so many examples of Donald Trump trying to change the subject. He talks about NFL players kneeling as a way to move away from what the real task at hand is.
You mentioned your parents. One of the things that caught me and why I thought it would be good to have this conversation now is because you responded on Twitter to the report of what the president said by saying my parents were from one of those countries. Tell me about your parents.
Well, my parents came here from the Dominican Republic. They got kicked out.
Were they married before they?
No, they got married in New York. My maternal grandfather was the ambassador to the United States. And in the early 1930s, when a guy named Trujillo took office, he had hoped that Trujillo would, who was trained by the U.S. Marines during the U.S. occupation of the Dominican Republic, he was hoping that Trujillo would turn out to be a good leader. And it became very apparent within a couple of years that Trujillo was a thug. He spoke out. He was declared non grata. And my parents, my mom's family settled in New York. My dad was part of what you would loosely call perhaps the student movement. He had to leave as well. And they came to America. My mother was the second youngest of nine, and four of her five male siblings served with pride in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. And my uncle used to proudly show me his war scars. He was willing. They were all willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for their adopted nation. And that's why when I hear these comments, they don't make America safer. Quite the contrary. Our commitment, that the dreamers who are fighting in the armed forces right now, what are they thinking? They're wondering, like, my country's about to abandon me. And my parents taught me to always keep the ladder down.
And what about your dad?
My dad was a doctor. He also served in the armed forces. He got drafted when he came to the United States, and he was initially
stationed.
So he comes
from the student movement.
He came to the States, got drafted. My two oldest brothers were born in Puerto Rico when he was stationed there. My third oldest was born in Atlanta when he was at Fort McPherson. And then when he got out of the Army, he got a job at the VA hospital in Buffalo, New York, and that's where my sister and I were born. They moved there in part because of the similarities in the weather between the Dominican Republic and Buffalo.
I feel like you've used that line before.
once or twice. But, you know, the combination of growing up in a great Union town like Buffalo, a city of good neighbors, as we call it, a city of humble people. For me, it was the best of all worlds because I was a kid when my dad died. And
how old were you?
I was 12. And my community took me in. I went to an all-boys Jesuit high school, and I had so many dads who were, you know, when the father-son breakfast came around, they go, oh, don't worry, Tom, we got you covered.
Right. Now, I was 6 and a half when my father died.
Yeah.
Now,
and
I went to
those things.
I went to an all-boys school, but it was not a religious school. So, but it does, and I mean, it shapes you in a way that...
It did. And, you know, I the Jesuits certainly taught me that social justice is who we are. And when I see attacks on countries that are so vulnerable like Haiti, it's so inconsistent with what every faith tradition teaches us in this country and frankly around the world.
Do you think that your father dying at that age, does that shape you? Does it shape how you think about what you do with your life?
Oh, it absolutely shaped me.
And, like, we're all shaped by our fathers, whether they're there or not, right?
We're all shaped by our life experiences, and what I didn't
mention.
And
our mothers too, I should say.
What I didn't mention is, if you had said to our family January 1, 1974, that one of our parents was going to pass away that year, we would have had unanimity that it would have been my mother.
Why?
Because she had some chronic illnesses. She had major surgery in late January that actually couldn't be done in Buffalo. So she had to go to New York City to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital to do it. And she came back. She was recovering. And then on Easter Sunday, my dad had his first heart attack. And it was more serious than I had been led to believe because they thought I was too young to, they thought I couldn't handle the truth. And so I was led to believe that all was well. And then he had a second and fatal heart attack a few months later. And then when we got back from the funeral, which was in the Dominican Republic.
So he's buried in the Dominican Republic.
So both of my parents. So when he got back, when we got back from DR after the funeral, my mom got sick again, so she was hospitalized for 3 weeks. This would have been August of 1974, so it was a tumultuous year to say the least.
Yeah.
My least
favorite.
Meanwhile,
you're 12.
You're 12 years old, and you're sitting at home at night.
Weird time to be a boy, anyway.
you got all that testosterone stuff going on. You got all sorts of things happening, and you are going to bed at night. You know, you're. you were told that your dad was in the hospital, but he was fine. And now you're told that your mother's in the hospital and she'll be fine too. And old enough to know the adage, you know, fooled you once, shame on you, fooled you twice, shame on me. And fortunately, my mom lived another 30 years and she was both a mom and a dad. But what that experience taught me in a nutshell was to have live with a sense of urgency, because you just never know. And I've always tried to live my life, and I tried to, I people in the workplace, you know, if you were to ask my colleagues, when do you see Tom angry? I think many of them will respond when he perceives that we're wasting time, because, you know, I don't know what the future holds in store. And so I think it's so important to have that sense of urgency, because, you know, Alexander Hamilton, and I've seen Hamilton three times, you know, there's one song that says, you know, why do you write like you're running out of time? Why do you fight like you're running out of time? Why do you live like you're running out of time? And he wrote, I think, 51 out of the 85 Federalist Papers in 6 months.
Yeah.
He lived his life with a sense of urgency. And I share that urgency because I talk to dreamers right now and they've run out of time.
You think Donald Trump is reprehensible. You think he's a racist. You think he's a misogynist. You said all those things. What do you say to the people who support him when you're trying to say vote for Democrats this year?
Well, what I say is you were voting for change, and I understand that. For many people, they felt the Democratic Party let them down. And so they were voting for change, and they thought Donald Trump would bring them change. Well, he is bringing you change, but it's not change for the better. He's making it harder for you to get access to health care. He's making it harder for union members to organize. He's making it harder for veterans to get access to basic health care. And these are the things that people care about most. And that's what frustrates me as much as anything about, you know, distracting Donald, is that we are hyper-focused on the issues that people care about the most. I want to make sure that people who work 40 hours a week can live a stress-free life. And then I see these budgets that cut funding for workforce training, you know, stuff that I did a lot of at the Labor Department. That's so inconsistent with what we need as a nation, and so inconsistent with what workers in Youngstown or in Baltimore City need.
Do you think there's a wave coming?
I think Democrats have a real shot in 2018 to win
a real shot
to win the U.S. House and the Senate and a substantial number of gubernatorial races.
And that would be a wave.
Races up and down the ticket. That's what we're working hard toward. I think we have wind at our back for a number of reasons. Number one, the Republican Party is overreaching. And number two, we're fighting for the things that people care about.
Is
people
that what
know.
It is? I mean, I feel like we are at a place where Donald Trump is the most present thing in almost everybody's life in all sorts of ways that we were never thinking about before, and where politics wasn't before. The NFL, you know, the entertainment, everything Trump is mixed up in one way. And it feels like we're at a place where people are voting like yes or no for Donald Trump. And to your point, a lot of those people voted no for Donald Trump. More of them voted no Trump than yes Trump in the last 6 months. And that explains, in part, at least, a lot of the wins that you guys have racked up, right?
Well, I think there's undeniable opposition to Donald Trump in some quarters that is motivating the passion out there. But I think also, you know, we are, and I've learned this from the travels that I went on to understand what we did wrong and what we need to do better. We're winning elections because we're leading with our values. Ralph Northam and Justin Fairfax and Mark Herring and others in Virginia, they were talking about health care. They were talking about it in Roanoke. They were talking about it in Northern Virginia.
A lot of people voted for Northam or didn't vote for Gillespie because they said they needed to send a message to Trump. They just didn't like Trump, right?
That's a big part of it. Well, but the number one issue in the exit polling, by far, was health care. Democrats believe that health care is a right for all and not a privilege for a few. And Republicans just passed a massive tax cut that's going to put 13 million people out of reach of health care. And people got that. They understood that their opioid-addicted loved one who needed Medicaid to get that treatment was in danger under the Republican proposals. And again, the 40% of the voters, the next biggest issue in the Virginia election had something like 12 or 13%. And so health care is an issue that motivated voters in Virginia and New Jersey and elsewhere. And in Oklahoma, where we won special elections, you know, there are school districts in Oklahoma right now that are going to school 4 days a week because of radical right-wing engineering.
Because they don't have the money to keep the schools open.
Because, you know, governors like Brownback in Kansas and other folks in Oklahoma are dramatically, they're supply-side economics on steroids. Reduce taxes, starve the beast, and people are realizing that their kids' education is their future. And so that's why we're winning in places like Oklahoma.
Someone who works for you here told me that it feels like you're fighting for democracy.
Absolutely. I mean, I think our democracy, as we know it, is at risk. You see the attacks on the independence of the Department of Justice. You see the relentless attacks on the media. These are what you look at Orban, you know, in Hungary. What did he do when he got into power? He cut the media off at the knees. He attacked the institutions of civil society. He attacked institutions within his own government that were supposed to be independent. The attacks on Planned Parenthood and the attacks on the labor movement and the attacks on trial lawyers are not a coincidence. They're part of a coordinated strategy from the far right and the Koch brothers and Trump and Ryan and McConnell to undermine grassroots organizing and make it harder for people to have a voice.
Do you think this is going to be the most consequential presidency we have, potentially? I mean, or one of them? It seems like it, right? That we're going to be in a different place on the other side of the Trump presidency than we were when it started.
Well, you know what? I'm chronically optimistic that we can turn this around.
It doesn't mean
a good
or bad thing, but it will have a lot of effects.
Well,
you think it can just be erased afterwards?
I think this is one of those "where were you" moments in American history.
It was, and
it's because I woke up on November the 9th.
Tell me about election night. As you want, and you
November the 8th. I was watching with my high school freshman at the time at home. I decided not to go to New York because I'd been gone for so long. I wanted to be with my family. And
this is after an election. You campaigned a lot for Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I did. And
you were very proud of it. To be her running mate at one point.
I've heard that. And you know what? I was proud to be out there on the stump for her. And I certainly woke up with a high confidence interval on November the 8th that we were going to make history again. I was obviously wrong with hindsight. And
you're watching with your son?
Yes.
What do you say to him about the election?
I said, I don't know what's going on. I thought we were going to win. And then he actually went up to bed around 10:30 or so. And I stayed up till, 1 in the morning that night.
On the phone.
And I was watching TV. I mean, I was texting with friends who were in the know. And, it was a shocking night. I mean, because again, I knew it would be close. But I thought the fundamentals were on our side, and again, I was mistaken. But
you had a bracelet that you wore from a dreamer, is that right? Tell me about that.
A woman named Ellie Perez. I met her on the table.
No relation.
Met her on the Ellie Perez. No relation. She's now a member of the DNC from Arizona. She is the first in her family to go to college. Born in Mexico. She's a little older than one of my kids. She's incredibly smart, passionate, and every bit as American as my three kids, with the only exception is she doesn't have the piece of paper to prove it because she came here when she was 3 years old. And she gave me a bracelet that said, su sueño, su voto, your dream, your vote, and the date of the election. And it was a reminder to me that Ellie couldn't vote. And we all had to get out there to be Ellie's surrogates. And I thought about a lot about that.
So that night, are you looking at that bracelet?
Absolutely. And for many weeks,
she's
I let her down, that the American people let her down, and that we need to work hard to bring it back. Democracy has seldom been, it's seldom been linear. We've had these moments in our nation's journey to form a more perfect union where we have
drifted off. This is how Obama talked about it right after the election, too.
Yeah. Well, it's true. And the shortest distance theory here in Washington has taken a beating. It's seldom part of the playbook of getting things done. But, you know, every time I've looked at American history, I've seen that people have risen up. And I had a choice on November the 9th. I could cower in a corner, or I could fight back. And I chose to fight back. My kids,
well,
my
family
Obama
chose
called
you
to fight
up and,
back.
And pushed you to run for chair.
Well, I spoke with the president about this. And undeniably, part of my motivation in running was I want to preserve the Obama legacy. There's no doubt about it. I want to make sure that people have access to health care. We were making great progress in job creation, and now I see the pace of job growth is slowing.
But
that
your first reaction sitting in the Oval Office when he pitches this to you is not like, great idea, Mr. President, I'm in, right?
Well, he wasn't the first one to pitch the idea to me, so I had to think about it. I mean, I had given no thought to that prior to the election because I frankly had a very high confidence interval that Hillary was going to win.
So I talked with Jeff Weaver, who is Bernie Sanders' campaign manager, a person you know well, who's still been involved in the Unity Commission stuff. Yep. I talked with a couple of other people, including Keith Ellison, who was your rival for the chairmanship and is now your deputy chair. And one of the questions that I put to them was, what is Bernie Sanders and that movement going to put into the DNC? For example, will he give the email list over to the DNC that he built up in the presidential campaign and before for help in building your voter file and reaching out to people? And they responded to me like I was asking a ridiculous question. What do you say to that?
Well, it's going to be up to Senator Sanders as to whether he wants to give us the file. I'd love for him to give us his information, just like Hillary Clinton did, just like Barack Obama did. Of course, I'd like to see that happen. But what I think is more important for me, and I saw it on the campaign trail, and Virginia is the great example, and that was this. This happened to me probably half a dozen times in the last 3 days of the election when it was crunch time in Virginia. People would come up to me at canvas kickoffs and they'd say to me, Tom, I was a Bernie supporter last year. I see what you're trying to do to bring the party together. Yeah. I strongly support it because we have a much bigger challenge, and that is taking back America and fighting back against Donald Trump. I am with you. And we saw that unity in action. When we are united, we are at our best as a party. We saw it in New Jersey. We saw it
in
Virginia
and
elsewhere.
You're going to have trouble winning elections if you can't keep everybody together.
Yeah, we're making real progress. We have more work to do. There's no getting around that.
I wonder when you see Sanders wants to influence the direction of the DNC and the direction of the Democratic Party. And the reaction that I hear from other people who are not with Sanders and Weaver and Ellison on this is like, you know, a lot is changing in what's going on here that is reflecting the influence of Senator Sanders and the people who support him. But you got to put into the pot too, right? And that doesn't mean just the email list or whatever it would be. And the response from the Sanders orbit seems to be, no, coming to us isn't a favor. It's something you have to do as the DNC. And that seems to be where the real division is breaking down right now. Don't say like, oh, in exchange for the help you've given us, we'll give you the list. They're like, no, if you don't listen to us, you're finished.
Well, you know, I've enjoyed a very good relationship with Senator Sanders, and a number of people on our senior leadership team were involved either in Keith's campaign or Senator Sanders' campaign. We have two goals here. We've got to win elections, and we've got to articulate our values. We're open for everyone.
I know you don't want to count any voter out, but it does seem like something fundamental is changing that is beyond what your message might be as Democrats or Republicans. There are cultural things that are all wrapped up in this, that certain voters seem like they're moving out of reach of the Democratic Party. And so also certain voters are moving out of reach of the Republican Party. Some of the voters that are moving out of the reach of the Republican Party seem like they're the young voters, right? And you see these numbers from Virginia and Alabama. It's an astounding differential in the Republican and Democratic support. But do you think that there are voters, realistically, who are moving out of reach of the Democratic Party?
Oh, the answer to that is no, and here's
There's
why.
There's not anyone?
Well, look, I mean, I think there are people who are never going to be with us, and right. So they're not our target market. So your question was, are they moving out of reach? And they already moved out of reach. And so
Or maybe they moved out of reach and you guys didn't see it.
They're not the target market, but you look at what's happened in races over the course of 2017. And, you know, Lee County, Alabama, is a county that I think is about 70% white. It went for Donald Trump by 24%. It went for Doug Jones by 17%. You know, Barack Obama, they're the Obama-Trump voter. They voted twice for Barack Obama. We can also win them back. And it's a false choice to suggest that we either focus on them or we focus on our base. And make no mistake about it. You know, the African-American vote in Alabama, African-American women in particular, was the linchpin of our success there. We can, our message of healthcare for all, our message of opportunity for all, our message that this is a nation in which we all succeed only when we all succeed. I think that message commands the majority of the American people. And if I'm the Republicans and I'm looking at the crosstabs in Alabama and Virginia, I'd be really worried, because young voters, they may not have an allegiance to institutions like parties, but they are aligned with our issues and our values. And that's why Doug did so well among young people, and Ralph Northam and Phil Murphy and others have done so well. The party of Trump, the agenda of the party of Trump, is anathema to the largest voting bloc in America, which is now our millennial population. And what we're doing in the party is making sure we are communicating and living our values every day.
Let me ask you two more and then I'll let you go. We talked all about the midterms. Let's talk about 2020 for 1 minute here. Is the response, you think, for the Democratic Party going to be more likely someone who is an established, built-up figure to be an opposition to Trump in that way? Or is it more likely to be someone who is a fresh start for the party?
You know, I don't know who the nominee will be. What I do suspect is that we will have double digits in candidates. I welcome
maybe
that.
Triple digits.
I don't think we'll get the triple digits, but I could easily see a campaign field of 15 or something like that. And I welcome that, because in 1989, there was a lot of hand-wringing among Democrats. Oh my God, we don't have a bench. And that proved to be false.
The point you just made about young voters would seem to suggest that people might want something fresh, someone that they don't, that they haven't, that hasn't been around a lot.
Sure. I mean, I think what people want is someone who articulates their values and speaks to their values and exudes the authenticity that they want. And it may turn out to be someone from the next generation, or it may turn out to be someone else. I think it would be very possible to have candidates who are currently mayors, candidates who are currently governors, candidates from the House and the Senate, and frankly, you know, candidates who are, you know, from the business community. I could see all of those coming forward. And I think the candidate that can really speak with that authenticity and really talk about, bring us together, because when we put hope on the ballot, we're at our best. That's what Barack Obama did. FDR, I think the most important freedom that Donald Trump is putting at risk is the freedom from fear.
Do you want Oprah to run?
If Oprah wants to run, we would welcome her. If anyone, that's going to be a choice for everyone to make. And if Oprah runs, she would be able to say that, you know, unlike Donald Trump, who was born on third base and thought he hit a triple, she earned her way around the base paths.
Last question about you. You were the labor secretary, which was a dream job for you. I know that another dream job was to be attorney general. That didn't come together. And there was some thought that if Hillary Clinton had won, that you would potentially be in the running for that. You also, as I mentioned, were surprised a lot of people by being on the semi short list for the vice presidential candidates, or maybe on the short list. It's always been a little hazy. You have, unlike the RNC chair, you have a 4-year term. RNC has 2-year term. So you're set through 2020 on this job. Do you see a future in government and politics for yourself beyond that?
You know, I can't even focus on next month, let alone 2020. This is an all-consuming job. And
is that just because you've been doing so much fundraising?
Well, it's an all-consuming job because, you know, frankly, you know, I walked into a place that was not firing on all cylinders, to be polite. And we don't have the luxury of time, because what I miss about my old jobs, Isaac, is I miss the opportunity to help people at scale. It's really fun to come home at the end of the week and tell your kid that you just helped enact a worker protection that enables 2 million home health workers, mostly women of color, on food stamps to get minimum wage and overtime protections. And that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. And we see through this presidency, elections matter. People are suffering as a result of the fact that we lost this election. People are suffering in states because so many state legislatures are eviscerating the right to collective bargaining. And we've got to work as a party to elect people from the school board to the Oval Office. And to me, the reason I did this job is I always ask myself the question, where can I make the biggest difference in the lives of the most people? And when we can build a party apparatus and a value proposition that enables us to elect Democrats, whether it's in the State House in Oklahoma or whether it's in the Oval Office here, we help people at scale. And that's what it's all about. That's what my parents taught me I needed to do. Leave the planet a better place than you found it.
All right. Tom Perez, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Well, that's Tom Perez with a big job on his hands. Thanks, as always, to Zach Stanton for producing. Remember to subscribe. Next week, NRCC Chair Steve Stivers and many more coming. Catch you next time on Off Message.